Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of the seventh and concluding session of our 2019 Becoming Buddha Immersion in the Dhamma Spring Retreat on May 19th, 2019. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Anapanasati Sutta. The Anapanasati Sutta uses the example of awakened monks to describe a skillful and authentic Dhamma practice. Information on our retreats is available at becoming-buddha.com, and if you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So it's always a bit of a challenge to decide which suttas to conclude a retreat. I think the last few retreats we've been using the Kakaya Yanagata Sutta and the Kulasekaka Sutta, and they help to summarize what occurred on this retreat or on any retreat. But I thought that we'd finish with another appropriate sutta called the Anapanasati Sutta. Some of you have probably heard that word in relation to a meditation technique. But as you hear in this sutta, the Buddha never taught a meditation technique called Anapanasati. It's simply the title of this sutta, and it relates to the subject matter, and I'll get to that in just a minute. Notice in this sutta how the similarities to the Satipatthana Sutta, but the subtle difference is that the Buddha's teaching this sutta using accomplished senior monks as examples of how to do Dhamma practice. So there's nothing in here that is specific instructions for a specific technique. What it is a very important and powerful teaching on this is what authentic Dhamma practice looks like. That's the purpose of the Buddha's teachings here. I have heard that on one occasion the Buddha was staying at Savatthi in the Eastern Monastery. This was during the Upasota day of the full moon. By the way, I think I mentioned it last night. Today is Vesak. Does everybody know what Vesak is? Vesak is a common manufactured date that most Buddhists around the world use to celebrate, and each tradition is different. Sometimes it's celebrating the Buddha's awakening. Some of it is his birth and death, and some of it is just his Dhamma, or his Dharma. But today is Vesak day. Nice day to finish retreat, isn't it? Many of the elder disciples were with him. Venerable Sariputta, Moggallana, Kassapa, Mahakakana, Kotita, Kapina, Kunda. These are all, if you read the suttas, these are all central characters throughout the suttas. Ravada, Ananda, and some others. During this time, the elder monks were teaching the Dhamma. Mahakapiya and Mahakunda, Venerable, and other, just reread what I just read. During this time, the elder monks were teaching the Dhamma. They were each teaching novice monks with groups ranging in size from 10 to as large as 40. The new monks were learning quickly and correctly. The Buddha arrived and was seated in the open air surrounded by the community of monks. Surveying the silent community, no idle chatter, he addressed them. Monks, I am pleased with what is taking place here in the dedication to develop the Dhamma and the realization of Nibbana. As such, I will remain here at Savatthi for another month through the fourth month of the rains. Typically, the rains retreat was 3 months. But because of the Buddha was so impressed with these novices, he wanted to be there and help them along. The monks in the surrounding countryside heard this and left for Savatthi to join the Buddha and that Sangha. A short time later, the Buddha addressed a large but quiet community. This community of monks is free of idle chatter and is established in pure heartwood. Again, always look at the beginnings of suttas is the Buddha setting his direction, and it's usually a pretty profound statement, including this. This community of monks is free of idle chatter and is established in pure heartwood. You could say that they're free of idle chatter because they're established in pure heartwood. And every time the Buddha's reference to heartwood is always to the Eightfold Path. I say that in my commentary right there, so I'll pass over it. The Buddha continues, this community is worthy of gifts and worthy of hospitality. This community is worthy of offerings and worthy of respect. Why are they worthy? Because they're doing something of true value to the community. as opposed to someone who is not and is not contributing to the community, they aren't worthy of gifts and praise, are they? And that's just a practical way of, these people here are doing something that is so important for you. They're worthy of your acceptance and your praise and your support. This community will bring much good for the world. And also look at this as the Buddha is talking to you today. These are the same words the Buddha used 2,600 years ago. This is a sangha. This is a community of monks and nuns, if you will, that has established a heartwood and has greatly diminished idle chatter. True statement?
Yes.
Yeah. The Buddha is talking to us. Due to their establishment in the heartwood of the Dhamma, when a small gift is given to this community, it becomes great, and a great gift even greater. The Buddha is not only talking about financial support in that way. The Buddha always said the greatest gift, the most valuable thing we can give anyone is the gift of the Dhamma. And that's more what he's talking about, the spreading that word. It becomes a great gift. It makes a great gift even greater. This community of monks is rare to see in the world. Even during the Buddha's time, a well-focused sangha was rare to see in the world. This community of monks is such that it would be worth traveling for leagues, taking along provisions in order to learn from them. In this community of monks, there are monks who are arahants. Arahants are awakened human beings who have fully developed the Eightfold Path and whose mental effluence are ended. Again, remember the setting. He's using these accomplished senior monks as an example of how to develop a Dhamma practice. These arahants have completed the task and have laid down the burden of continued eye-making, of maintaining anatta. They have attained the true goal and abandoned the fetter of becoming further ignorant. They are released through right understanding, as opposed to there's no release from wrong understanding. Again, I was just talking about the importance the Buddha kept placing on a right Dhamma practice, developing right understanding.
Did you put right view in there?
Right, yeah, right understanding is euphemism for right view. In this community of monks, there are monks who, abandoning the five lower fetters, are totally unbound from clinging to ignorant views. Their minds continually resting in equanimity. Such are the monks in this community. And these are the five lower fetters that these accomplished monks have let go of, have abandoned. Self-referential views or continued eye-making. Grasping at rituals and practices that only continue. In parentheses are my commentary, it's not part of the sutta. In parentheses, that only continued self-referential views. Uncertainty or lack of conviction, which rises from that. Craving for sensory stimulation and ill will towards oneself and others. In this community of monks, there are monks who, abandoning the first three fetters and with a diminishing of passion, aversion, and deluded thinking, those are the first three fetters, greed, aversion, and delusion, have established a heartwood and will make an ending to stress. Again, remember the setting. The Buddha is using these monks as an example. By them addressing and abandoning greed, aversion, and deluded thinking, they were able to establish the heartwood. So there's a symbiotic relationship there. There's a recognition that this is a problem in me, and the path develops the path. And as I develop the path, I'm able to diminish these. Talking to people. It's hard to talk to you when you can't see it. This is a little better. The Eightfold Path provides us the framework to diminish greed, aversion, and delusion. The initial intention, and you could say the initial right view, is that I have this issue. How do I deal with it? Deal with it through the Eightfold Path. And these senior monks are examples of that. They have established a heartwood and will make an ending to stress. They are in the stream of the Dhamma, resolute, developing the cessation of suffering. Their minds are inclined towards awakening. Such are the monks in this community of monks, meaning this accomplished group as opposed to everyone else. In this community of monks, again, just making the point, in this large community of monks, there are these monks who have remained devoted to the development of the four frames of reference, the four frames of mindfulness, the four exertions, the four bases of power, the five faculties, the five strengths, the seven factors for awakening, the Noble Eightfold Path. So we covered all these, not necessarily in that same nomenclature. And it sounds, when you read it in one sentence, it sounds almost overwhelming. The four bases of power and the five, what is all this? But we've learned all that this weekend. And we know that it's a matter of integrating this. There's not going to be a test before you leave here. You have the rest of your lives to understand this. And the Buddha is saying the same thing to this group of monks. This is what authentic Dhamma practice looks like, and it takes time. Like some of the Sariputta, Moggallana, Kassapa, they were with the Buddha for almost his entire teaching year. Kassapa came in a little bit later. But that's the devotion, too, that it takes to the Dhamma. Such are the monks in this community of monks. Now, in relation to the four foundations of mindfulness, they have developed mindfulness of the breath in the body. They're mindful of feelings arising and passing away, mindful of thoughts arising and passing away, and mindful of the present but impermanent quality of mind. So again, the Buddha's just saying they did this through the four foundations of mindfulness. And then they did it also through this right effort, this aspect of the Eightfold Path. Right effort is avoiding inappropriate thoughts, words, and deeds that have yet arisen. How do we do that? How can we prevent ourselves from having unskillful thoughts that aren't there yet? What's the vehicle for doing that?
Concentration.
Concentration. Who said that?
John.
All right. Outstanding. Really, John?
That's the four bases of power.
Yeah, you're done. You're good to go. Abandoning in this group of monks have abandoned inappropriate thoughts, words, and deeds that have arisen. This is in relation to their right effort. They're developing appropriate thoughts, words, and deeds that have yet arisen. And they're maintaining appropriate thoughts, words, and deeds for continual development of non-confusion and skillful qualities that have arisen. Again, it's a lot of words, but the Buddha is saying that from that well-concentrated mind, you can now hold in mind these principles of the Dhamma. And this is what it looks like. They have developed the four bases of power, which are calm, rooted in concentration. We're developing that every time we meditate, and the more we integrate the Eightfold Path. Persistence, the next base of power is persistence rooted in that concentration, which implies that we really can't have kshanti, patient persistence, if our minds aren't concentrated. And we've all experienced that. And I bet you we might have even experienced it a little bit on this retreat, that we were grasping a little bit too much at getting this rather than that well-concentrated mind that just allows us to be present and take in what we can take in and continue to develop that path. So when we understand persistence from the point of view of a well-concentrated mind, it's a very calm and peaceful persistence too, right? It's not an agitated persistence of acquisition.
Yeah, I find that when I approach the retreat, I'm still in that space of wanting to and seeing it as a huge task. And then when I'm here, I just let it come.
Yeah. Well, that's the nature of retreat. It should be the nature of retreat. It should be that way.
Yeah.
It should be something. I think I said to John earlier, a lot of it has to do with just showing up. And it's true. I mean, there's a lot to do here too, but you have to bring yourself into this structure if you're going to learn it. And that's part of it. And part of it is just, nobody could, except maybe Kevin, could recite any sutta word for word, could you? You might. Yeah, I think if you thought about it, you might be able to. But each and every one of them has impacted you in a very useful and effective way, haven't they? Mm-hmm. But it's self-referential ego self wants to own this. And so we own it by memorizing it and maybe even reciting a few phrases to show how much we know. That's not Dhamma practice, is it? This is Dhamma practice. And it's different for everyone. Some of us are Kandanas like John back there, and some of us are Ananda. like the rest of us. But it doesn't matter, does it? Because we have established the hardwood. That's the only thing that really matters to a Dhamma practitioner's life, but to anybody's life, it would be valuable. The goal is certain as long as we, and this is what this sutta is about too, this is what it looks like if you just do this. Wisdom rooted in concentration. The five faculties that they've developed. Conviction, which relates to right effort. Enthusiastic engagement, which relates to right view and right intention. Right mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. The five strengths that they have. Conviction in the Buddha and his Dhamma. Conscience, which means having the ability to feel non-self-referential shame. To know when you've done something that is hurtful, but not beat yourself up over it. And the Buddha talks about that often. In fact, I have people say, why would the Buddha talk about it? It's good to be shamed at some of these things that we do. Well, isn't that beating yourself up? It can be, if you don't have the right context. Another reason to be gentle with ourselves. But it's knowing that I've done something hurtful to myself and to others, even from a especially from a non-self-referential point of view, is shameful. It's shameful to me. But it doesn't mean that I'm beating myself up over it or falling into regret or even doubt, as sometimes can happen. It's just there. I recognize, shame is just a word that I've recognized that I've done something that is unskillful, period. But it's a good word. It gets right at the point. The Buddha's using the word that we have conscience, meaning that we have the ability to be shamed at our behavior. How else could we learn to change that behavior? Concern for the suffering that arises from misconduct. Persistence for integrating the Eightfold Path in the framework for mindfulness and for one's life. Wisdom and discernment, or penetrative understanding of the arising and passing away of suffering and all phenomena. Discontent, which is the ability to see things, discernment is the ability to see things appropriately and with the appropriate context. Discernment is a quality of right view. So we can't discern anything properly unless we have the framework for understanding it. Not just the Dhamma, but anything in life. We have to know what we're looking at here. If I go into a bread box hoping to change the oil in my car, I'm not going to do it, am I? I might get frustrated as hell because where is it? How do I do it? Well, it's not happening because I'm in the wrong space. If I want to get to New York and how does that go?
And I'm in Chicago.
I'm not going to get there. Yeah. We have to be in our place.
If I'm
in New York and I want to go to Los Angeles, but I think I'm in Chicago, I'm lost. I can't get there. How could you? Pardon me? Well, it's going to be much...
You have those...
You understand what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
we have to know where we are. And if we don't know where we are, we have to have a method for putting us in our place. What else would it be but a well-concentrated mind? The seven factors of awakening. Mindfulness, penetrating investigation of the Dhamma. Enthusiasm, rapture, meaning joyful engagement with the Dhamma. Calm, concentration, and equanimity. They've developed the Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, right understanding, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right meditation. In this community of monks, there are monks who remain devoted to the development of goodwill and compassion, to concern and equanimity. They understand the relentless decay of the body and the impermanence, the arising and passing away of all conditioned things. Such are the monks in this community of monks. If you're reading along, I'm skipping over my commentary here. In this community of monks, there are monks who remain devoted to mindfulness of the in-breath and the out-breath. Mindfulness of the in-breath and the out-breath, when appropriately developed, is of great benefit. Mindfulness of the in-breath and the out-breath, when appropriately developed, supports the concentration necessary that brings the four foundations to their culmination. Look, and you're all seeing this as instructions on what a Dhamma practice looks like, correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Friends, this is the direct path for the purification of all beings, for the cessation of sorrow and regret for the disappearance of pain and distress, for establishing the right method of practice, and for complete unbinding. In other words, these four foundations of mindfulness. This is from the Satipatthana Sutta, and I'm just including it in here to make that connection. These four foundations of mindfulness, when appropriate developed, bring the seven factors of awakening to their culmination. The seven factors for awakening, when appropriately developed, brings clear knowing or right understanding and release from clinging to wrong or ignorant views. Now, this section of it, mindfulness, the monks and the nuns, they have established mindfulness of in and out breathing. Now, how is mindfulness of in and out breathing appropriately developed so as to be of great benefit? A Dhamma practitioner, having gone to the wilderness, to the shade of a tree or to an empty hut or building, sits down, folding his legs crosswise, holding his body erect and setting mindfulness to the fore. They begin to do jhana. Skipping ahead. Buddha continues, always mindful of the breath, they breathe in. Always mindful of the breath, they breathe out. When breathing in long, they notice that they're breathing in long. Notice the Buddha doesn't say, now spend 10 minutes with long breaths. He just said, notice whatever, however your breath is presenting yourself in your body. The Buddha teaches, and I do too, to just, that's your breath. If it's a long breath, the Buddha teaches, notice it's a long breath. That's all. He's just saying, be mindful of your breath. When breathing out long, they notice, I'm breathing out long. But that's not something we have to say to ourselves. It's not that, again, the Buddha is describing the practice. It's not instruction. So they notice they're breathing out long. He's reflecting what's going on in your mind.
Like you notice it experientially rather yes. than making notation.
Yes, instead of making a meditation practice of, I'm breathing out long. From breathing, but it sounds
people
silly.
Do,
but
people do that.
Many people do that, and again, not making fun of them. But that's why the Buddha gave these specific and very clear instructions, so we didn't fall into those types of unskillful patterns. Or when breathing,
it's a new condition.
It's also clear evidence that you're here.
Exactly. Exactly.
And there's a breath somewhere in between a long breath and a short breath. It
just is. Your breath is just is as everything else is. How's that for it? A compound sentence that hardly made any sense.
yeah, but without, I mean, I know this is a repetition, but without appreciating that, you're probably somewhere else.
Exactly. And again, you have to, the Dhammapada chapter, I gave a talk on two Thursdays ago, the Buddha says it's that. You heard me say it. If there's no repetition, there's no Dhamma. And here, I mean, this is pretty repetitious, you know. And it could be distracting. Nobody really wants to hear that. It becomes boring to hear the same thing over again, unless we're wholeheartedly engaged, and then we'll learn from it. Or when breathing in short, they notice I'm breathing out short. Or when breathing out short, they notice I am breathing out short. Just notice it. And honestly, because of meditating this way and not trying to manipulate my breath, I never even consider whether my breath is long or short. It just is now. Remember, this is what it looks like. This isn't instruction for how to meditate.
Sometimes in the beginning, when I first start, it's kind of short today.
Yeah, I mean, I think that for a lot of people, becoming familiar with their breath is a bit of a challenge, and it takes some time. The more, especially people that have a lot of trauma. In fact, beginning breath mindfulness meditation can be often difficult because the breath puts them in a place they don't want to be. You might help me. If you have any comment about this, Chris, please help, or please do so. A person suffering from trauma resolves that continually by being outside of their body for the most part. And so the Buddha teaches something different. But for someone who has a lot of severe stress, and I've talked to them, that it's almost too harsh to be thrust into your body that quickly. And so my instruction then is to everybody to start meditation with short periods of time. And I usually say 3, 4, 5 minutes is plenty to get started. To those that I know have PTSD or any type of traumatic emotional injury, not necessarily physical, start with 1 minute or 30 seconds. And if you become uncomfortable with that, stop. Yes?
The co-regulation, so sitting with another person who has a really a lot of equanimity in observing and experiencing their breath, just having another person sit with someone when they're first learning how to do that and create the calming equanimity through their voice and their love and the energy they're directing toward the person, that starts to create the equanimity in the other person who hasn't experienced that before. So some people can be coached to learn to be friendly with their breath at one place, like feeling it at the nostrils or feeling it at the abdomen, depending on the person. So that can be coached. And then that's where sometimes like the method you started with, like TM, or using an object like a candle can help people who have trauma.
You're also pointing out the importance of a sangha.
Yeah.
Because there's a large group of mindful, gentle presence. You know, and I've also said that to we've had that has occurred within our sangha more than once. It's not something obviously to make a point of, but Matt knows they have done very well with this. You know.
And people say they always have a better set when they're at the sangha. Well, not everyone. People say they have better sits when they're at the...
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't say I have better sits, but I look forward to Tuesday and Thursday. You know? All right, let me continue. They train themselves, I will breathe in, sensitive to the entire body. Some would take that now that, okay, I need to breathe in and look at every part of my body. Did the Buddha tell us to do that? It's just being sensitive to your body, that you are in your body. That's what it means. We are sensitive and conscious beings. Use those senses in a skillful way rather than an unskillful way. Being sensitive to the body is another instruction to practice the Dhamma at the point of contact. Sensitive to the body. Be mindful that you are now uniting your mind and your body. He trains himself. I will breathe out. Sensitive to the body. So he used 50 words to describe that. Sensitive to the entire body is often taken as instruction to change one focus from the breath, to now to beginning to incorporate all bodily sensations as ever-changing points of focus. And again, that's a commonly taught form of meditation. Wherever you find a sensation, put your mindfulness there. And if it's painful, breathing, and all these other things. Well, that may be helpful. In fact, there's a component of that Jon Kabat-Zinn used, incorporated very successfully. Remember, that's a different practice. And so if we're taught to do that in meditation practice, to find a part in my body that I'm sensitive to, what am I doing in that moment? I'm distracting myself to the pain in my knee or something else, or the fluttering in my stomach. And I'm not focused on my breath. I'm not deepening concentration. And the Buddha's sole reason for teaching meditation was for concentration, not to resolve issues we might have with our body, because he knows that those issues resolve from a well-concentrated mind developing that refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. I'm going to skip over that, the rest of my commentary there. Now he's talking about how these monks develop this ability. They train themselves. I will breathe in, calming bodily fabrications. This always needs a little bit of instruction and context. We're not manipulating bodily fabrications. We're not trying to calm. I'm not meditating. Oh, I gotta calm this fabrication before I can. It's not that. I breathe in. Bodily fabrications calm. as a function of doing the meditation practice, bodily fabrications come. It's not the intention to do that. He trains himself, I will breathe out, calming bodily fabrications. As a consequence or as a function of breathing in and breathing out, bodily fabrications come. He trains himself, I will breathe out, sensitive to rapture, joyful engagement. He trains himself, I will breathe in, sensitive to pleasure. Just sensitive doesn't is not grasping, is it? It's just you're aware, you're sensing of it. It's part of your understanding, but you're not grasping at it. Sensing that I'm sensitive to pleasure, I understand the allure and the drawbacks of pleasure.
And the difference between rapture and pleasure?
Rapture is kind of an archaic word, and again, it's a translated word. The best description is joyful engagement or joyful but gentle focus on something. So being enraptured with the Dhamma is what that refers to, is I am joyfully engaged and well focused on it. You know, the biblical setting of rapture is a little bit different than that.
Another way to say it is like as you're breathing and you're in this absorbed, concentrated state, the experience of joy is permeating that. You're feeling joy in the concentrated state. It's part of the...
And remember, joyful enthusiasm is one of the seven factors of awakening. It's there to be cultivated as part of that. And it's also to be seen as a consequence, as a development of authentic Dhamma practice too. Here he trains himself, I will breathe in, sensitive to pleasure. They train themselves, I will breathe out, sensitive to pleasure. They train themselves, I will breathe in, sensitive to mental fabrication. Now he's relating this to the five clinging aggregates too. He trains himself, I will breathe in, sensitive to mental fabrication. He trains himself, I will breathe out, sensitive to mental fabrication. Excuse me. He trains himself, I will breathe in, calming mental fabrication. He trains himself, I will breathe out, calming mental fabrication. What's the Buddha teaching here? In a very real way, mindfulness of the in-breath and the out-breath begins the resolution of the problem of the five clinging aggregates. It begins to build the perspective distance so I can see them. And again, I think Liz might have brought this up, why is it so difficult? And it's, again, we need that perspective distance because otherwise we're just too close to see it. You know, it's us. It's how we describe ourselves to ourselves anyway. He trains himself, I breathe out, calming those mental fabrications, those form, the feelings, the perceptions, the mental fabrications. And they train themselves, I will breathe in, sensitive to the mind or consciousness, the fifth clinging aggregate. He trains himself, I breathe out, sensitive to the mind. Another way of saying it, I breathe out, just aware that there's a mind there. The reason why I'm saying that is the mind is just the mind too. There's nothing special about it. We can greatly over exaggerate my mind because it's the seat of my fabrications, isn't it? So it's the most wonderful thing in the world, my mind. It's mine. The Buddha would say it's just mind. It's one of the function. It's one of the common six properties that every human being has. There's nothing special about it. He trains himself, I will breathe out, calming the mind. He trains himself, I will breathe in, steadying the mind, calming the mind. They train themselves, I will breathe out, steadying the mind or calming the mind. They train themselves, I will breathe in, releasing the mind. I will breathe out, releasing the mind. They train themselves, I will breathe in, focusing on inconstancy or impermanence. I breathe out, focus just being mindful of the impermanence. And of course, that's the breath, in-breath and out-breath. They train themselves, I will breathe in, focusing or being mindful of dispassion. So again, these aren't meditation little mini meditation practices. You're bringing from that well-concentrated mind, you're able to hold in mind all these different factors of the Dhamma, right? Is that clear?
Yeah.
And that's the development that the Buddha's using these monks as examples of. This is what they've done. They've developed this presence and this quality of mind. They train themselves, I will breathe out, focusing on dispassion. They train themselves, I will breathe in, focusing on or being mindful of cessation. We're holding in mind what the purpose of this is. Why I'm doing this. Why am I even doing this meditation practice? To ultimately develop the cessation of all views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And I should maintain that mindfulness of it. Not to the point of distraction, but no, this is the focus. This is why I'm doing what I'm doing. There's nothing ambiguous about it. They train themselves, I will breathe out, focusing on cessation. They train themselves, I will breathe in, focusing on relinquishment or abandonment or release from clinging to all views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. That's relinquishment. He trains themselves, I will breathe out, focusing on relinquishment. This is how mindfulness of the in and out breathing is developed and pursued so as to be of great benefit. The four foundations of mindfulness. Now, how is mindfulness of the in-breath and the out-breath appropriately developed so as to bring the four frames of reference, the four foundations of mindfulness, to their culmination? On whatever occasion, a monk breathing in long is mindful of breathing in long, or breathing out long is mindful of breathing out long, or breathing in short is mindful of breathing out short, or breathing out short is mindful of breathing out short. They continue to train your mind. So again, a lot of words, but what the Buddha is saying is that simple act of being mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath is training the mind. It's deepening concentration. They train themselves. I will breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to the body, bringing mindfulness to the four, to what is occurring, and uniting the mind within the frame of reference of the breath in the body, uniting the mind in the body. They train themselves. I will breathe in and breathe out, again, calming bodily fabrications. On this occasion, when this occurs, this monk remains focused on the breath in the body in and of itself. In and of itself, again, means free of distraction or any embellishment. It's just the breath. Ardent, alert, and mindful while putting aside craving and distress with reference to the world. Meaning letting go of any clinging entanglements. In that moment, the next moment it might come up again.
John, is that the same as like in the Dhatavibhanga Sutta, where it's saying, I'm sensing a feeling limited to the body.
Yes.
I'm sensing a feeling limited to human life.
Yep. Yeah, thank you. It's just there. And in that sutta, in the context of that sutta, it's just a feeling that is in the six properties. None of it's me. Just a feeling. Thank you, Matt. My comments here. With reference to the world refers to a mind clinging to the world through wrong views rooted in ignorance of the Four Noble Truths, as a means of continual self-establishment or eye-making. So the reason why that's there, and I'm just saying it now, is, again, that simple but incredibly powerful meditation, breath meditation the Buddha taught, hence the title of the sutta, not the method, it brings us the foundation to let go of all those wrong views, to liberate ourselves. But again, it takes a concentration practice. That's really the emphasis. There's a few different emphases, but the major emphasis the Buddha's teaching the novice monks is just that. The same thing I emphasize often. This is a practice of deepening concentration. And nothing else as far as meditation is concerned. I tell you, monks, that the in-breath and the out-breath, this is just a reaffirmation of that. I tell you, monks, the in-breath and the out-breath is unsurpassed as a body among bodies. It could be confusing, but again, look at the Buddha's instructions. Using the breath to unite the mind and the body separates it, focuses your own scattered establishment of yourself here, there, and everywhere in between. Remember the Bahiya Sutta. But when you are here and you're not here, there, or anywhere else, then Bahia, you are awakened. Just watch out for the cow. What?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, I mean, that's what I was trying to say earlier. Each and every one of these things, although there are a great number of them, is in each and every realization, or in each and every awakening to that, whatever that is this realization that you're here.
Yes.
And that's when rapture occurs, I think, for me, is that I have this little inner chuckle that I'm right here.
Yeah.
I'm not spinning out there somewhere.
Yes.
It may last, like you say, so briefly.
But isn't it marvelous?
It is that little rapture of, you know, what, on any of these points.
Yeah.
It's just an appreciation, I think, for evidence that I'm here.
Yes. And again, it that is a marvelous feeling, isn't it?
Yeah,
I mean, there's literally nothing like that, and you've all experienced it, maybe just for a few brief moments, but it's what's real. That's where life is.
Yeah, and the more I practice it, the more time I spend it.
Yep. There's a Dhamma, Larry. Thank you. That's what it is. And let me continue. Well,
I just want to add one thing. When you're absorbed like that, it creates a release of neurotransmitters, and anything that we do that supports our neurotransmitters makes it easier to access those states, from nutrition and exercise to every other thing that takes care of the body. Then anyway, so the neurotransmitters, they've shown in the research, are really boosted when people are in absorbed states.
Oh yeah. That's the whole point.
To absorb states, you're going to
Thank you. I tell you, monks, the in-breath and the out-breath is unsurpassed as a body among bodies. On the occasion that one remains focused on the body, excuse me, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful, they are putting aside craving and distress with reference to the world. On the occasion that one remains focused on the body, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful, they are putting aside craving and distress with reference to the world. It's what you just said, Larry, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And how did we end the pain of craving and distress? What was required? An Eightfold Path. Yeah, and nothing external can give me that, can it?
Understanding that these feelings are impersonal and as such impermanent.
Yeah. It is. It keeps coming back to those basic, the Buddha's Dhamma keeps coming back to that basic theme of not taking feelings and thoughts personally. Why? Because when we do, we're out of our body. We're not present. And when we don't take them personally, we are present. I mean, there's the focus, but the brilliance. I mean, I think about this a lot, probably more than I should. But it's astonishing to me that a human being figured out these such subtle but also obvious things. I mean, how can you say something is subtle and obvious at the same time? But they are, aren't they? But this guy was able to figure it out. And he was able to figure it out because of what he discovered and talked about in the Nagara Sutta. He went from a frame of reference, an internal frame of reference, that could not reference what was actually occurring, to developing a frame of reference that was appropriate to what's occurring. Four Noble Truths. When I think about it, that's astonishing that someone could come up with that, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, no instruments, no nothing. He just, his own, but that's when he calls himself a rightly self-awakened one. He's making the point, not to be arrogant, I did it, and now I'm just like you. I'm teaching you to do the same thing. And there's nothing in it that we can't do. That's my commentary. There's a little bit more about what that, the body and the body, but it's not all that important, but you might want to read this later. On any occasion, a monk trains himself, I will breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to rapture. I will breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to pleasure. I will breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to fabrications. I will breathe in and breathe out, calming mental fabrications. And the way I take this is the Buddha saying these things that are prior to Dhamma practice are distracting and often debilitating. Now we can just breathe them away. I breathe in and breathe out, bodily fabrications calm. Again, it's not just meditation. It's within the framework of the Eightfold Path that we're able, again, referring to the heartwood, that we're able to frame what's occurring in meditation. I will breathe in and breathe out, calming mental fabrications. On this occasion, the monk remained focused on feelings, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful while putting aside craving and distress with reference to the world. I tell you, monks, that mindfulness of in-breath and out-breaths can be seen as a singular feeling among feelings. Mindfulness of the in-breath and out-breath can be seen as a singular feeling among feelings. What the hell does that mean?
Those are feelings limited to the body.
Prior to meditation, I've had a rough day. I've had arguments with 16 people. My dog ran away. Oh, how did I say that? I hope he didn't run away. Can't wait to see Bodhi. And I am distracted, and my feelings are everywhere. Mindfulness of the body. It's just one feeling. I might have an endless description for all these different, seemingly different feelings. But feelings in the body are just feelings. The description of them is often a distraction. Sometimes it's helpful to notice, well, I'm sad or I'm happy, etc. But not to take it any further than that. But a feeling is just a feeling. A happy feeling is rooted in the six properties. A sad feeling is rooted in the six properties. There's essentially and practically no difference. They're just feelings. Right? Everybody see it? That's living in a dispassionate life. My feelings aren't, from the Aditya Pariyaya Sutta, my feelings aren't fueling the passion anymore. I'm not burning myself up with that. They're just feelings. And then I can have any feeling I want, or not any feeling I want. Well, I can have any feeling I want because I'm in control of them, and any feeling that I do have and acknowledge is just a feeling. It enlivens me no matter what it is. Even if it's something from great tragedy, if I'm mindfully present, hearing that a loved one died is an awful thing, no matter how mindful and awakened you are. But it's also enlivening when you're present in it, because it's an aspect of life. You're not refusing to have an experience of life that is inherent in life. And if you insist on doing that, you're out of life, aren't you? So it doesn't mean to when you hear that. My mother was the most wonderful woman you ever met. Never said a bad word about anyone, but she loved this one joke. She just loved it. To the day she died, she would fall on the floor if you said it to her. I was just sitting in the house quietly one day, and there was a knock on the door. And there it was, Western Union outside. And he said, I have a telegram for you. I started wrong.
It's okay.
She said, my sister Rose was at home one day, and there was a knock on the door. Western Union says, I got a telegram for you. He says, please sing it. He says, well, I don't do singing telegrams. Oh, I started it wrong too. Forget about the Sister Rose part. A person's home, knocking the door, Western Union, blah, 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 blah. Please sing it for me. I've never had a singing telegram. I want a singing telegram. Please, lady, I don't sing. I can't sing. I don't do a singing. Right. Yeah, and listen, you don't want me to sing this particular telegram. Please, 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 I need to have a singing telegram. I never had one. Okay, lady, be ready for it. Your Sister Rose is dead. Your Sister Rose is dead. Be careful what you ask for. Be careful what you want. I had a little bit better tie-in with what I was saying, but I lost it while I was telling a joke.
I can't resist it. I can't resist this. So. I'm going to say, in my pre-awakened state, my father died, and I had none of these things that you're describing, and it was a very, it was just painful, and I was angry. I mean, it was none of what you were describing.
Oh yeah.
And then I anticipated my mother's death, and I felt the same way pretty much about her. And she said, which is what keyed me, she always said, if you don't have anything nice to say about somebody, don't say anything at all. Mm-hmm. And she must have said that 1,000 times to me. So at her funeral, I was planning to get up in front of everybody and say, my mother always used to say, if you don't have anything nice to say about anybody, don't say anything at all. And then I was going to sit down. No.
Which is...
This is funny. But I'm dead serious. I mean, I look forward to that opportunity, and I was just for many years. And then I discovered this, and the last 7 years of our life together were completely different. And the thing I want to emphasize here is that when she died, somebody said to me, oh, you must be sad. And of course, I think I was sad. Yeah. Just all these things you just said. But I also said spontaneously, which they found odd, it was a beautiful death. Mm-hmm. And it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. It really was. And it was because of this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And and what we're talking about right now, the end of life, is included in dukkha, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And as we understand dukkha, we are accepting of it, but we learn the difference between acceptance and approval. I didn't approve of my mother's dying. No, who would? But I accepted it, and it's still a remarkable experience. You got me thinking, the first understanding of death I ever had was my best friend died when I was 14. And because of the circumstances, I blame myself. I wasn't responsible for it, but I did. And I carried that with me for many years. And I was angry at everybody because of it. I was angry to begin with. And because of this, how could this happen to me? Because I so personalized it. And I had no frame of reference or understanding. I carried it for many, many years. And I blamed myself for it. 45 years later, I had another death. I mean, everybody has death in their life. My mother died, and it was a completely different experience. And I won't say it was wonderful because it was so pleasant, but it was wonderful because I could stay. She really suffered at the end, but I could be there. I could stay with her without the need to escape. I mean, not just escape the room where she was in, escape the situation, to be out of my body. Mm-hmm. And I maybe I'm kidding myself, but I think she felt it. Mm-hmm. She had a lot of things when she. Her brain stem was gone, so they say when that happens, you can't feel or think or anything. But I think she did. But it was so, to this day, I'm not about to cry, so don't worry about it. To this day, it was one of the most profound things. And Maslow would say a peak experience. But how could it be when your mother died? Because I was present for it, that's all.
Yeah,
it can be.
Yeah, I held her hand when she just took her last breath. And it was beautiful.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's beautiful and it's awful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's just life.
If mm-hmm. you allow it, there's a generosity of spirit that can come at the end of someone's life. And sometimes that's because of the setting you're in. The other family members encourage that. And it can be a really beautiful experience.
Yeah.
If you don't deny it, fight it, want it to be different, you know.
Yeah, just like everything else, just like all of life. And again, we don't train ourselves to be peaceful at loved ones' deaths. We train ourselves to be peaceful all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so when situations arise, we're still peaceful. We're able to, that's the essence of a mind resting in equanimity, isn't it?
I always think of that as being one of the greatest benefits that my sisters are going through this with me, is that when my mother dies, we'll be able to handle it differently than maybe we would have 5 years ago.
Yeah. Wow.
Because we'll understand, you know.
You will.
We'll understand the difference.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to hear about it too, you know, as a part of our sangha. Let me try to finish this. We might have to cut this a little short. It's almost 11. I tell you, monks, that mindfulness of the in-breath and the out-breath can be seen as a singular feeling among feelings, which is why the monks on this occasion remains focused on feelings free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful. Obviously, if I'm free of the distraction while focused on feelings, it's because I don't want that feeling to be any different than it is. Buddha's teaching that. They remain ardent, alert, and mindful while putting aside craving and distress with reference to the world. Another complete Dhamma teaching in that one sentence, isn't it? Ardent, alert, and mindful while putting aside craving and distress in relation to the world. There's an intention there too, isn't it? The Buddha's teaching that my intention is to remain ardent, alert, and mindful while I'm putting aside craving and distress in relation to the world. Craving and distress is wanting something from what's going on, and distress is that I won't get it, or I might get something that I don't want. Again, going all the way back to the Buddha's description of dukkha. Whenever a Dhamma practitioner trains themselves, I will breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to the mind. They remain focused on the mind, free of distraction. Again, what does it mean to be sensitive to the mind? It's really just an acknowledgement that there is a mind. It's that fourth foundation of mindfulness. I'm sensitive to it. I don't have to be focused on, is it a pleasant or an unpleasant quality of mind? It's just mind. I'm sensitive that I have a mind. And to take it just a little bit further, I'm sensitive that my mind is in this has this quality right now. That's it. Not in this moment, the quality of my mind is agitated. I can't wait till it's not. That might seem like the appropriate next thought, isn't it? But that thought itself is a distraction from being mindful that your mind is agitated. So what do? I don't hope that it's better. I take a breath and continue with my Dhamma practice. And eventually, I build these moments of pure equanimity until they literally encompass our entire life. Just like Larry was saying, we build these little moments of insight and peace and understanding.
I think you can, it's palpable. You know, you see yourself, you catch yourself in different situations and think about how you might have reacted to that even a few years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And you just, it's so comforting to know you can come out the other side without all the angst and drama and
Yeah. Whenever a monk trains himself, whenever a Dhamma practitioner trains himself, I will breathe in and breathe out, satisfying the mind. Again, it's not the intention of breathing in and breathing out isn't to satisfy the mind. Breathing in and breathing out satisfies the mind. What is a dukkha means? In a general sense, it means all kinds of suffering. In another general sense, it means disappointment. I'm having an unsatisfactory experience, whether it's a singular experience or my life is, in general, unsatisfactory. I will breathe out and breathe out, satisfying the mind. I've just resolved that issue of disappointment. In that one sentence that Buddha is saying, we can resolve the issue of the First Noble Truth with the Eightfold Path. That's his direction. I breathe in and breathe out. Another way of saying satisfying the mind is I breathe in. I'm halfway there. I'm almost satisfied. Now I am. Yeah, it worked again. My mind is satisfied again. It's just that way. That one line, again, you hear me say this, that one line is an entire Dhamma practice when you understand what Dhamma practice is. That's the whole point. Larry just described having that experience momentarily. The Buddha is describing it in a slightly different framework, but directly related to meditation practice. Another way of looking at it is you could be having a difficult day or feeling like you're unfulfilled. Things are disappointing and unsatisfactory. And you can remember this. I know how to satisfy myself. I don't need a bottle of vodka or a new puppy. I just need to find a secluded spot and do jhana. Back in satisfaction. John, do you have something?
Oh, no, I just...
Okay. I will breathe out and breathe in, satisfying the mind. I will breathe in and breathe out, steadying the mind. I will breathe in and breathe out, releasing the mind. They remain focused on the mind, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful while putting aside craving and distress with reference to the world. When this occurs, only when this occurs, the monk remains mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful, while putting aside greed and distress, craving and distress with reference to the world. I do not say, this is, again, one of those singularly important statements from the Buddha from 2600 years ago. I do not say that there is the development of mindfulness of breathing for one who is forgetful of the instructions or who is not fully aware of these instructions. I'm not going to get to Nkula Sakaka, but that's an excerpt. As the sutta concludes, the Buddha concludes, he says, but I do declare that those that do remain mindful do achieve the awakened state, do develop this process. So that's the sutta. It's 11 o'clock, but I would like to have a few minutes to talk about this sutta and just kind of a concluding talk here on our retreat. Pardon me? Oh yeah, and we'll finish with the Karaniya Metta Sutta. Did everybody see this sutta as it is? It's a description of Dhamma practice, not instruction for any specific type of technique.
Yeah.
And
it's a deeper understanding, that's for sure.
It's a description of the result of what happens.
Yes, and in that way it's a valuable resource to just read and read and read again, because it just, and again, without grasping, because there's a lot in this sutta, like the Satipatthana and some of the other ones. Read it, take it in, just as the Buddha's describing. Steady your mind with it. And slowly, what the Buddha's describing here will start manifesting in your life. Why? Because you're doing it. You and all of us are doing exactly the same thing that Sariputta, Moggallana, Ananda, and the Buddha did from 2,600 years ago. We've just spent 3.5 days immersed in that. And it's been a rather wonderful experience, I would say, for everyone. Correct?
Yes.
If there's anyone here that hasn't, please tell me, because I want to hear it. I'm serious about that. Whether, again, please give me some feedback if you weren't disappointed in anything, or if you felt like you missed something. But it's pretty remarkable what can be developed with 3.5 days of focus, isn't it, in the Buddha's Dhamma. I bet you all feel like you know a whole lot more about what it is and what you're doing than you did.
Sure.
I do, by the way.
Yeah.
Matt, I bet you do too, even.
Yes.
But Matt's a good benchmark for that. Okay, let's. We don't have time to go around the room, but anybody have any comments at all? Anything you'd like to share, or insights you gained, or praise you want to heap on the teacher? Anything like that?
No. No, I mean, really, thank you.
You've talked for 3.5 days.
That, well. You know, I could go on if you want. I got a little bit left in me.
What will be left for the fall? That's what I want to know. I'm a neophyte, so I've been exposed to plenty.
You wait.
John,
don't get him,
you know what? You know what's here for the fall?
Practice.
Repetition.
Yeah.
You're going to hear the same thing over and over again.
But you hear it a different way every time it's said, so you can.
Or sometimes as if you've never.
Or a different sutta that illustrates the same concept.
There was 4 suttas this week or this retreat that I haven't done on retreat before. So,
and it'll be different when you start to employ the practice.
Yeah.
As Kevin and I leave here and perhaps go to Storm King together, but we will be re-immersed into our golf discussion. And I'm reminded of that because there's perhaps the best golfer ever was a man named Ben Hogan, and they always wanted to know a secret. And he said, the secret's in the dirt. And by that he meant practice. Practice. That's what the fall is more practice.
That is. Practice makes perfect. So if we really want something, we want to be a great golfer, you practice.
But the river is different every day, And so every time you sit, there's a new opportunity for information to come to you and a new way of understanding. So you sit every day to see what the river's doing that day.
Because of impermanence. It's always new. A well-focused Dhamma practice is always inspiring. Excuse me, I shouldn't say always. It's often inspiring, and it should be, shouldn't it? And if it's not, look at the seven factors of awakening and cultivate them. Cultivate that aspect that factor of awakening of joyful enthusiasm. Recognize what you're doing. Recognize this incredibly fortunate gift that we've been given. It doesn't have to. I mean, again, things that I think about that maybe I shouldn't. It's astonishing to me that these teachings are still available in their pure form. When you read, and most of you have read the article on the Pali Canon on my website, when you read that, you see it's just remarkable. First, with the lengths they went to establish and maintain these teachings, and then that they were able to, with a method that is rooted in the Dhamma itself, how they were able to preserve these teachings in their pure form. It's remarkable. Anyway, any other questions or comments?
I wanted to share it as just an adjunct to the golfing thing. How many hours it takes for a golf pro to keep playing their game well? They spend hours and hours training, and it's repetitive neurological rewiring. I don't know if that helps any of you, but it's really helped me to understand that. And training the mind towards equanimity and acceptance and penetrating awareness, etc. It's the same thing. It's repetitive neurological rewiring until that pattern in the brain is stronger than any other pattern. Mm-hmm. And if I think I should be able to do it in less time than pro golfers do it in order to play pro golf, then I'm missing part of the understanding of what's required by the brain in order to change the brain.
Yeah. What?
So
that's helped me to understand that.
What Chris is describing is conditioning your mind another way. You know, and it has they now have the measurements that can prove that how we think changes our brain structure. It's not the other way around. And so you could say that each and every in-breath and out-breath, you are deconditioning your old brain and you're conditioning a new brain. And that's absolutely true. That's not speculation. We know that's true.
Yeah.
So why not do it?
That makes it easier for me to do it, understanding that it's that there's a scientific basis for it. So.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, I get it now. Yeah. I feel very reassured by the last, 36 hours. Just generally, just very kind of what Chris was saying sort of explains, the impatience that comes up. And I think Ron was touching on it too when he first got here. I was experiencing that. I can't remember the word he used, but it was patient persistence. Mm-hmm. You're doing it. You're just doing it. You just keep doing it.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of settles things down and has helped me focus on what I should be focusing on and letting go of what I should not be focusing on, getting wound up and urgent. Really worked up, and that's to the point of destruction. Mm-hmm. And a lot of hindrance that's keeping me up, keeping me from engaging as much as I need to in order to clock the hours of practice. So that's been really helpful.
That's great. And so you've noticed a deeper development of that inner poise that the Buddha talks about in the jhanas. And it's such a good example of how we take that inner poise, that seclusion off our cushion, and now it's just something that's part of your life, isn't it? That's how it happens. That's how it works.
Previously, I was always looking for big insights coming out. A retreat, and I'm actually now experiencing what you call it, like the immersion in the Dhamma, and becoming really familiar with it, so that to use it in daily life, it becomes almost automatic.
Yeah, it is, and then at some point it will be automatic. Yeah.
Seamless.
Yep. It's just how we. I mean, that's the framework for how we live our life. And so we start with just that we got to. You're telling me we got to get going, aren't you?
No, I know. Oh, okay. I just wanted to say.
You should tell me, because we do have to get going.
No, I just.
We'll just clean up really fast.
Yeah, you don't have to. Well, we don't have to be there right at noon either. We don't want to be too late, but.
I just wanted to say one thing, and David and I were talking about this last night, and Chris had touched on it as well last night, and I think we all recognized it last night, that this retreat in particular, and John talked about this too, all the retreats are different because of who's here. Mm-hmm. And there was a real Sangha moment on this retreat that was very inspiring to me. And, you know, I'll try to get this out, but you know, when John fell and hit his head and got hurt, and the momentum of everything shifted, and there was, people were scared, and we were worried, and we were upset, and there was a lot of emotion that started to move, and everyone really showed up together in a very grounded and calm and nurturing presence that we've all worked so hard to develop over these years of practice. And reeled it all back in. And put it all right back into just what's occurring. And didn't spin out, didn't get lost, demonstrated the maturity to you know, address our Sangha as a Sangha, including the teacher, including each other, including everyone as the Sangha. And that, you know, you gotta be dedicated to do that. You really gotta be dedicated to this practice. It's important. And it moved me a lot to see.
It moved me a lot too, I could tell you that.
Thank you for falling on your head.
Thank you. That's true.
Thank you, Matt.
Well, yeah.
No,
I'm ashamed.
Although we will welcome that opportunity not arising again.
Yes.
I will be more mindful. My
presence. I was saying to Mary and Jen that the thing that I was the most impressed with was that there was no wrong speech coming from John when he hit his head.
Really?
I don't think I could have gracefully hit my head and not said the S word or something.
Yeah.
Well, I am the junior member here, not in age, but in participation. And so my not being in the present moment, my not being as mindful of you as you are, it contributed to my being the one that injured himself. And I think in the future, I will be more in the present moment, more mindful.
It's a hell of a
more
mess.
Aware.
Yeah.
However, good for you, John.
If you're injured again, we will take care of you again.
Yep.
And if I fall again, I will want to fall with you guys.
Thank you.
And we'll take care of you the same way. I thought it was remarkable too. One of the things, the most remarkable thing is out of, in a normal situation when something like that happens with a group of 12 people, there's 12 experts on what to do next.
Yeah.
There wasn't. Matt took the helm. Kevin, our doctor in residence, made sure John was okay. And we took care of it.
Yeah.
And then as a Sangha, even the discussion about what to do that night, as a Sangha, we decided appropriately to let's keep things going the way they are. Let's keep the Sangha together. And it's remarkable, but I have to say that I've been a part of all kinds of different so-called Sanghas, and there was never this type of true, I don't even want to say connection, togetherness. Because of this single understanding that we have. We understand suffering. We understand John's suffering. We understand everything now. In the context of how to appropriately be as a Sangha. The Buddha, I wish I had time, because one of the great suttas is a sutta where Ananda asked the Buddha that question, his cousin. What's the most important part of the Dhamma? And the Buddha says the Sangha. And then he goes into the reasons of it. So that's on the website too, if you want. It's called the Anupada Sutta.
And it's like a smaller, more egalitarian community, so that really supports that.
Yeah.
Supports the interconnection and the growth together.
Yeah.
In the love and equanimity.
Yeah.
There's much truth to that, by the way, as an older, and as also the senior in age. But I've done some reading in Buddhism, and I think the contribution of ideas that I have received here in Sangha far outweigh in effect upon me of anything else that I have read just from opening a book.
Yeah. I would say this, you know my story. I spent many, many years diligently studying all the different forms of Buddhism. And it wasn't until I actually came to this that it made all the difference in the world. You could say that one small book replaced all those other. I mean, I still have a library of 300 books that I got to figure out what to do with, but I won't. And I'm hesitant to give them away because they're some of the greatest Buddhist books of all time. But I can't figure out what to do with them because to me now they're misleading.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll figure something out one of these days.
They could make up a wall of a future Buddha center that.
And put it under glass with a lock and say, don't read that.
Do not read these.
That's the wrong view.
Read only this. There's a very powerful art piece, and I forget the name of the artist, but it's a wall of books. So it's just books laid on top of books, laid up like a brick wall. And in the middle of this wall, which is an entire room, is one little pebble. And then the book goes around it.
Uh-huh.
So the whole wall is flat, but in the middle there's one little bump. And then it shows you how all the books above it are set out of place just a little bit because of that one little pebble.
Wow.
So these Buddha books would be great for something like that. Find an artist. They'll figure out what to do with
them. Yeah, I'll figure something out.
Also, I've never been to a meditation community where there was such an absence of posturing, so much genuineness and openness and honesty, and no one's going, look, I'm doing it well, look, I'm doing it well. No one's doing that. And the sharing is more, to really either give something or to be vulnerable about something, or anyway, and I've been around too. I've been around. So you're just kind of like, whoa, okay, guys.
It is. It,
fantastic.
It's all remarkable. And let's not forget what's supporting this. Mm-hmm. We decided to take refuge in the Buddha, his Dhamma, and a well-focused Sangha. That's why this is.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we had what happened with John and everything else that's occurred, has occurred and has we've experienced it because the only thing we've done here is engage with the Dhamma and a little bit of Qigong.
And also
but,
your leadership, John.
Well, again, thank you. I'm not dismissing. I want to hear that because I want to know that I'm actually doing something that's useful.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Beyond that, I really don't care. I know, you don't, nobody, you believe it or you don't. It doesn't really matter. But the only reason I can teach trying to make it work.
But you have really absolutely
absolutely okay.
I know. Oh, it's no. I just I don't want to lose. I don't mind about crying in people. Obviously, I don't. I just don't want to lose the focus that happens. I couldn't teach what I teach if some guy didn't first do it 2,600 years ago.
But also, John, you know, to give you credit where credit is due, is that you had the ability to see what wasn't necessary, what had become convoluted, and you were able to parse it down to the to a purer form of what the Buddha said. And I've had this much experience. Chris has had a lot of experience. Ram has had experience. And so there are people in the room who have seen it done differently. Mm-hmm. And this is a basic, practical way of living your life without... that makes sense.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
And that works.
Yep.
I mean, that's the thing, it works. So
yep.
you were able to find that and to communicate that.
And you keep mm-hmm. doing it.
And
you
and
keep
show
you stay
and what?
And show it. I mean, you,
yeah.
as you are here, you show the Dhamma.
Well, I
not
hope so.
Just what you say.
No, I hope that, for the most part, I do example the Dhamma.
Mm-hmm.
But I hope, and you all do too.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I greatly appreciate what you're saying, and I do take it to heart. And it's never lost on me that I didn't figure this stuff out.
Right.
But and I don't think too much about why I got to that point and dismissed what I had learned up until that point and said there's got to be something else. I don't know why. Some people, modern Buddhists, might say, well, it's karma. You must have spent many lifetimes studying it. That's meaningless, isn't it? Even if it's true, it's meaningless. The point of the matter is that I wanted to find a way of living in the world that could bring me peace and happiness that nothing could affect. And I found it.
And you've preserved
yeah.
the tradition, therefore enabling a transmission of that Dhamma to all of us. So that's
well,
yeah,
no, that's right.
So grateful.
But the point that I'm making is this is how the Dhamma should work, isn't it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Even though it's from 2,600 years ago, it's still present, and we are the proof that it's still effective. And
yes.
and proof is important, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's that saying that the truth doesn't need a defense. It does. The Buddha's truth has been under attack for 2,600 years, and it still is. It just to use a strong word. But we've embraced it, and we've developed it, and we've had the benefit. Me too. To me, from my point of view, the person who has great benefit the most from the Dhamma and the teaching of the Dhamma is me.
Yeah.
I am so fortunate to have what's developed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because of you, not because of me. There's not much Dhamma to teach when there's no one to listen to it, is there?
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, to make the point, you are as responsible for, to use the word, the reemergence of the Buddha's Dhamma as I am.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, maybe more so. Because if I'm just sitting here talking about all these wonderful suttas, they're going to lock me up. They're going to put me away. But because I have an audience for this nonsense, I seem reasonable.
In some circles, it's just referred to as the light of another man's thought.
That's what a wonderful way of putting
it.
Because that's what it is.
What
yeah.
The what?
That's what
the light of another man's thought.
The light
yeah.
of another man's thought.
Yeah.
yeah.
The light of another man's thought.
Life?
Light.
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 Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
we
can say we can say I to Seiko, and we can come see for ourselves.
Yeah.
But you have to come to see something, and in this case, it's the light of another man's thought.
Mm.
Thank you.
You thank your aggregates for continuing to pursue until you found just the things the Buddha taught.
Yeah. Well, that's true. Thank you all.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Matt.
I was saying to, I think, Jane last night, it's remarkable. It's possible that we have a group of people come together, and you might not like everyone, especially people over time. You might say, well, this one, it'd be better if they weren't around, and this one. there's not a single person in our Sangha, including the two new folks, that I do not want to associate, that I would think twice about associating, that's not the right way of saying it, that I want to associate with you. I want you to be in my life and I want to be in your life. That's not that common either, is it? Mm-hmm. And I would bet that each and every one of us feels exactly the same way. That's remarkable.
Yeah.
That there's not someone here that just kind of rubs us the wrong way. There isn't. Well, sometimes Kevin, but... it's because of the underlying reason that we came here. We came here to learn, like Chris pointed out, we came here to learn, not to tell.
Absolutely.
All of us, me too.
Absolutely.
So that's enough. We are wonderful people, and it's a wonderful sangha, and it's time to end this wonderful retreat.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.